I would like to call the meeting back to order. Thank you. We'll just wait for Mrs. Polis to return, and then we'll reconvene the meeting. While we're waiting, I would like to take the opportunity to remind the audience and ask for your patience and indulgence for some bit of time. You understand that we are conducting the business of the school district here at this meeting. And we would like you to honor the decorum of that meeting. This is an official meeting of the school board, and it is necessary to have order in this meeting for the board to conduct its business. I will ask you to please refrain from any shouting, yelling, or disrupting the meeting with private conversations that interfere with the meeting. I do want you to know that if necessary, I do have the right to ask that the room be completely cleared, except for, of course, media representatives, and so that we can properly conduct our business. If necessary, I will do so. I do have law enforcement officials who will assist us in that process if necessary. So, again, I do ask that you respect the decorum of the meeting and bear with us as we go through the process of the business of the school district. Thank you very much. With that, we're working with Ms. Shoemaker. All right, we are back in session.
So I was questioning the requirement to have parents fulfill a specific number of participation hours. I don't know if charter school law allows that to happen or not. And then that leads into my next question, which is there's a school parent student contract in here, and at the bottom it says, please note any repeated violations of this contract will result in a meeting with the executive director. Continued violations will result in your child's enrollment being revoked. And I can completely understand, if somebody's breaking the rules and things like that, their enrollment being revoked. But in a community where both parents work and things like that, I hate to see a contract that says your student's enrollment at Edison can be revoked because you can't participate in the required hours. And so I don't know if that's legal, allowed, and even if it is, whether or not it should be there.
This is an issue that Mr. Simmons and I have discussed before. Not surprisingly, we disagree. It is an issue I would want to discuss in moving forward with this.
Okay. Okay. Those questions have been answered already. In the proposal, Edison is reserving the right to decrease educational the school year based on funding from California. Do we have any say in that? Because it has been a priority of our school district to have as many instructional hours as we can and as many instructional days as is possible. And I would hate to see it cut because of funding. Because I know as we're going through our budget process, we're looking at different ways to fill the gap rather than cutting the learning time.
I would be inclined to believe that is what is known as a material amendment to the petition. Mm-hmm. I think that if that hypothetical did come up, then that would be I'm not comfortable with the language of we reserve the right to.
Okay.
So I think that in the looking at the context of what's going on at the time and what the circumstances are, I that would be something I would want to discuss as to whether that is a material amendment. That's my thought
okay.
on that.
And then there's one part that talks about San Jose Charter Academy will determine a student's eligibility for special education services. I believe that that is the student's team that does that, and so maybe there needs to be discussion on the language there. And I will get you page numbers and everything else. It was nice to see two members of what will possibly become the board of directors at Edison. One identified himself, the other one didn't mention it, but that's okay. In the employee qualifications, they talk about the criminal record summary prior to commencing employment from the Department of Justice. The school district also does FBI, and so I would like to at least see the same there. You already addressed that one. I've already said what I feel about the facilities and the payment for them. We've talked about disputes. We've talked about risk management. Okay. When we negotiated the contract, there was specific language put into the contract regarding how people on the waiting list were to be notified. And that included mailing certified return receipt requested, because as we know, many times people change phone numbers. It was a great way of letting the community, which has for a long time accused Edison of not notifying people in the correct order, of keeping a record that people were in fact notified. You know, certified return receipt, federal government stamps it, it's in the student's record. I see in this proposal that they want to go back to just making a phone call. And so, again, I would like to see the stronger language that really shows that students are being notified properly and given the opportunity to enroll if they so desire.
That's the page 79, right?
Yes. funding, we've already talked about. Sorry. A lot of these have been answered, you'll be happy to know. 1% for the oversight, we can talk about how much has been spent in attorney's fees, whether or not the board members necessarily agree that it was necessary, but, you know, part of our oversight is still going to be special ed. And that has been where a lot of the attorney's fees this year have come from. The 1%, I would hazard to say at this point, wouldn't even cover the attorney's fees we've had regarding our oversight duties in the last year. We talked about the classified employees. We talked about internal disputes. I already mentioned to you that the closure procedures and reasons for terminating the charter is more detailed under our current agreement, and this one really doesn't have a lot of that same detail, so I would like you to look into that and see what we could do about it. When it comes to buyback services, it's my understanding of the charter school law that although the terms independent and dependent are not in the code, it's sort of become terms of the educational field, dependent versus independent. But one part of the code that's very clear is on what constitutes a dependent versus independent when it comes to services. And one of the ways that it's determined whether or not a school is dependent versus independent is the amount of services provided by the school district. And I feel that if Edison would like to go this route of going independent, that they need to contract for services outside of the district. They need to get their funding directly from the state, from the federal government. That way there's no question on whether or not Title I funds that they should be receiving or being received, categoricals, anything. The money will go directly to Edison. And then if they want to enter into a contract with us to provide food services, that could be something done in the future. any services in the future. I would prefer it to not happen, period, because, again, no muddy in the waters. But at least if you had your own fund that you were paying us for the individual services and a contracted rate, there's no discussion on whether or not you're not getting a percentage of what you should back. Okay.
Can you say that again?
I'm saying they need to get their money directly, and that if they want a service from the school district,
then they send the money back.
Such as food services, we enter into a contract for them that says, okay, we'll give you food services for $3 per student for lunch, and Edison will pay us $3 per student. There isn't a mixing of our food services fund.
Oh, I see. I see what you mean. Okay.
So there's no discussion of
if right
we
now,
get
right now
they pay us like
an independent
contract.
Right now they do a flat rate for all kinds of services.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, I get you. Okay.
And that way, you know, the statement was made that the district may be keeping some reimbursements that they shouldn't. That will make it very clear we're not. I've expressed some concern with our council on some of the bylaws. I know as an independent charter that we may not have we don't have a say over your bylaws, but I will say that areas of concern for me regard the nominations by committee for the board of directors, the fact that there is no detail on how a director can be removed, the creation and powers of committees is a little bit confusing. A duplication of office holders, I would prefer to not see a duplication of office holders. Loans to directors and officers, it's mentioned that the corporation shall not lend any money or property to or guarantee the obligation of any director or officer without the approval of the California Attorney General. I would just, period. No, there will be no time that a loan will be given to a director or officer of the corporation, regardless of who outside can approve it. The facilities use agreement, I know, is something you're still reviewing, and so I'll leave that alone for now. Again, maintenance we've already discussed, and insurance we've already discussed. So those are my only concerns for tonight. I expected tonight to be a public hearing, and as I've heard from our council, they're still in the process of reviewing this document to give us a final legal opinion. And so I just hope that we continue to keep this as a public hearing and opportunity for board members to share some concerns, and we do not take action tonight.
Mr. Spence.
We've spent a lot of time over the last 2 years talking about the differences in liability between profit and nonprofit, or the theoretical liability between nonprofit and profit when it comes to the liability of the school district. By shifting this from the for-profit and then now that the charter would belong to a nonprofit, what are those differences going to be as far as the liability of the school district, the theoretical liability?
Theoretical liability is that if the charter school is operating as a nonprofit public benefit corporation, which is what they propose, then, as I had indicated before in regard to the dealing with the oversight obligations of the district, what the law says is if you have a nonprofit public benefit corporation that is operating or operates a charter school, that the district that authorizes it will not be liable for its the charter school's liabilities and omissions and errors and omissions so long as the district has been providing all of the oversight it's been obligated to provide under the law.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and the difference is then with for-profit that's still there even if we did all that.
That theoretically, I haven't seen this happen, but theoretically, right, the district doesn't have that statutory immunity that's granted under the Charter Schools Act. If a charter school is being operated or governed by an entity other than a nonprofit public benefit corporation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On the governance piece that's in here, and this is something that I know the board we have to discuss with CAVA, There's a place in the charter school law that allows the board to place a representative on the charter board.
That's correct.
And I guess there's discussion on whether or not that person could be a board member or not board member and the different conflicts that there might be because of it.
That's correct. It's right now, it's one of these unanswered areas of law. I'm concerned about it because you're right, the conflict issues come up all the time in regard to the member serving on the charter school board who's the district representative, where their loyalties lie. Mm-hmm. As
we have two on the COBA board.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And so there is a I'm trying to think there's a legal obstacle course that is done when somebody's serving on those boards in regard to when they should step away from discussion and recuse themselves from discussion.
Now, if we chose to exercise that option, I don't know if we will or not. I mean, how do we go about figuring that out then? I mean, do we do someone that's not a member of the community that's not a member of the board or staff? Or, I mean, is that possible for us to do? Is that something allowed by us?
Yeah, you can have anyone serve as the district representative, but we do not recommend because of the because of conflict issues that may arise of having somebody who is serving as a board member or somebody who is or the superintendent, someone who has discretion to take action against the charter school that they themselves serve on the board.
But assistant superintendents are okay?
Unclear. I see it done.
Uh-huh. Wow. All
and once again, this is probably a discussion best served for a confidential memorandum, but an unclear, because the area of law is so open. And I talked to folks at the Charter Schools Association, talked to people in Mr. Simmons' office about this, and we're not necessarily all on the same page.
Okay. Because I think that's because there are some differences in the governance that would take place between the nonprofit and the for-profit closely held corporation of Edison. Because we don't have access, for example, to many of Edison's corporate records because there's no requirement for them to give it to us. They're not a public health corporation. But we would have access to some of those records should it be a nonprofit entity like that. Is that correct?
I think that I'm not necessarily familiar with all of the issues that may have come up before. I think the law would be much clearer that if you have a nonprofit operating this board, that I think there would be clearer guidance that you have access to make reasonable requests for information and to obtain documentation from them.
Than we would with a privately held corporation. Is that correct, Mr. Simmons? I mean, is that kind of, because I kind of see that when I look through here, you know, the Edison board in New York's not subject to the Brown Act. You know, public record requests would be much different. You know, those kinds of things.
I think that's exactly right, Trustee Spence. And I guess the only caveat I would add to that is that, of course, students do have a right to privacy, for example, in student discipline matters, and employees have a right to privacy as well as to things that are in their personnel records. And so, obviously, regardless of who their employer is, the employer has the obligation to protect those sorts of personnel records. However, outside of that, I think you would find significantly more transparency in this model because the charter school would be subject to the Public Records Act, whereas the Edison Corporation in New York is not.
Let me add one other possible nuance to that. The Public Records Act simply doesn't apply to public records that are generated by the agency subject to the Public Records Act, but it talks about records owned, used, held by the public agency. One issue that comes up, and one good example, is where you have a consultant or vendor that prepares documents, their private business, but they're related to, they're paid for by the public agency, and requests come up for documents to the public agency for which they're held by that private third party that are relevant to that request. I wouldn't say that simply because they're a private party, whether it's Edison Learning or whether it's an architect that serves on behalf of the district, that those are not subject to the Public Records Act. I think it's very contextual.
Okay. But it's much clearer and much easier, though, in this system to sort through that, though. I mean, that, at least it seems to be. I have a question about the makeup of the school population, because we've allowed Edison School, for example, if someone gets in the lottery and then they move somewhere, and there are families I know that do this, they drive quite a distance to keep their kid in Edison School. So that kid is no longer in our school district, and we're making money off of them, you know, from the 1% buyback, et cetera. But how does that work then when we deal with the balance reflecting the school district issue? And I know there was the Huntington Beach case that kind of went probably a different way. You know, how does that all play out, and how is that judged?
What are the district's obligations? I mean, the charter school's obligations in regards to
the charter has an obligation dealing with making sure that the charter school's reflective of the population of the school district.
Correct.
Right? And I know there's the Huntington Beach case.
Well, of the population the school district serves.
Yeah, but that's my question, is that when our school district, because if you leave West Community Unified, you can still keep your kid in the Edison Charter School.
Correct.
You know, how is that evaluated?
Yeah, sure.
See what I'm saying? Do you see what I'm saying?
I mean, it's not. You know, so in this case, you know, the statute requires that the charter school make, you know, describe in the petition efforts that we'll make to achieve the racial and ethnic balance of the general population of the district. In this case, as you'll see in the charter petition, the charter school's student population almost precisely mirrors the district's population. And so in this particular case, names drawn out of the hat happen to be reflective of the district's population, and so therefore the requirement's been met. There certainly are other charter schools elsewhere where I had one circumstance where they had a random public lottery, and you know, there was an approximately equal number of Hispanic and white students in the hat, but 80% of the students drawn were Hispanic students. And so, you know, the random public lottery sometimes can result in, you know, through luck of the draw, unusual scenarios like that. But in this case, the student population is, in fact, reflective of the district, and so that hasn't been an issue to date.
I have a follow-up question that Mr. Spence is going to allow me to interject. When it comes to the balance, he did, I asked. Is it only the racial ethnic balance, or does it apply to maybe like English learners or special ed, things like that that make up our school district?
Well, so the statute refers specifically to racial and ethnic balance. It doesn't specifically reference other protected classes. However, obviously, the charter school cannot discriminate against a student in admissions based on special education identification or based on any other sort of protected class. And so, therefore, they have the same random chance of having their name drawn in the random public lottery as a student who is not from a protected class. So, in that sense, you know, it's really luck of the draw, you know, and that I think system was set up by the legislature specifically to avoid the sorts of, you know, wonderment about, well, is this particular school in some way, you know, admitting people in a way that is discriminatory on any basis?
I guess the other question isn't really for the lawyers. It's just something for the board to consider, is that when we look at, you know, the budget and the way Edison allocates the budget is, you know, they're able to spend much more at the school site. And, you know, I almost want to figure out if there's a way that we as a district can then say empower school sites with, you know, the money, and, you know, our district has oversight, and people can, they can buy back services from us, and see if we're able to get more money into the individual school sites to be able to serve those kids there. I mean, that's just something I'd like to see us do as we, I know we have a budget coming up, but, you know, I think that model of being able to spend stuff locally, I think is a benefit, so. I think it's more dollars in classrooms. That's it. The other ones were already asked.
Okay. You have more?
I have one more.
Go ahead.
This goes back to the classified. If they decide not to stay, and it sounds like you really hope they do stay, but for some reason they decide that they don't want to stay, will they bump? Will the nine individuals that come back, will they bump our existing employees, or do we have nine openings for the individuals here?
That's
Mr. Seaman?
Currently, we don't have 9 openings for the individuals. If they chose to come back, then we would have to either figure out if we have other needs to create openings, or we would have to do a layoff. And those people would come back, less senior people would be laid off.
Okay.
Which is what Marina was demanding to negotiate, the effects of that layoff.
Okay. I guess I did one more question.
Next. I did have a question about training for your board. Are these members experienced with charter schools? And if not, is there going to be training done? Because, again, schools and oversight of schools is very different than, say, a normal 501c3.
Sure. So Edison Learning does provide training to boards that it affiliates with. But in addition to that, the California Charter Schools Association has a conference each year, which has an entire strand, much like you go to California School Boards Association conferences. There's an entire strand of presentations at the California Charter Schools Association that's specifically designed to train charter school board members. And our office also does trainings regularly for our clients on Brown Act, Conflict of Interest, Public Records Act, and sort of best practices in governance. So the charter school will have a lot of different resources that it can draw upon, both the association and our office and Edison, for that purpose.
Thank you.
Mr. Spence?
Well, I guess I had a question, and I guess it's for our attorneys about process from here. And I know Mr. Cox hasn't spoken yet, but, you know, we've been through this before, and if I remember right, there's different options we can do. We can have meetings like this where we negotiate stuff. We can empower somebody in the district to negotiate, or we can empower a couple of board members to deal with you and as you deal with Edison. Is that basically the three?
That's correct.
Okay.
Okay, you're done.
Yeah, I mean, I said I was right. I'm not going to say anything.
The agreement will
I'm going to stop. This may
go without saying, but the agreement will then come back to the full board for ratification.
Right, yes, of course. Yeah.
Okay. All right. As Ms. Shoemaker noted, this is a public hearing, and it's important that we hear from the public as to the going forward with this petition process, and that's certainly what we intend to do. What I would like to do is, or suggest to the board, is the establishment of perhaps a subcommittee of the board members to take 2 members of the board and work with both attorneys and staffs to incorporate all of the questions and concerns that we have either expressed here tonight or may have in addition to, and perhaps we can then submit those questions to, you know, our staff and have those addressed on this board. I sat on a meeting in 1998-ish or whatever it was, with Chris Whittle, and it was a long time ago with the implementation of this program. And as we move forward, I'm real excited about the opportunities that this has to offer in the district and going forward in a very positive manner. What I would like to do is suggest to the board that I and one other member of the board, and I'm suggesting perhaps either Mr. Spence or Eileen Miranda Jimenez, as parents of students at the school right now, serve on that subcommittee to enter into negotiations, making sure that we get all these issues answered to the best that we can, and not necessarily negotiate the contract, but certainly implement the wishes of the board as we continue sitting down and moving forward with this so that we can move this forward in the most efficient manner possible. Anybody have any objections to that?
I do.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'll make a motion then that we appoint a subcommittee consisting of the president and the vice president to work with our attorneys and to negotiate a contract with San Jose Academy and to bring it back to the board.
All right. Is there a second to that motion?
Can they legally exclude board members
from a subcommittee?
Well, and form a subcommittee on an issue that's always been spoken about publicly. because I am 20% of this board. I was elected by the community, and I have a right to be involved in the negotiations.
Yes, I think the Brown Act certainly does allow the board to form subcommittees of less than a quorum of the board, and I think the caveat that Mr. Sklar gave is that ultimately that subcommittee doesn't have the authority to approve a final document.
Correct.
And that final document needs to be brought back to the full board for review, consideration, and potential approval.
Except that the members of the board not on that committee will have no idea of whether or not their interests and thoughts are being represented, or even the majority of the board's thoughts. And we'll get a finished document.
I don't know that to be the case.
And we wouldn't, definitely would not have privy to the conversation that went on, that as people communicate, you hear more things, and you may change your mind, or it may generate more questions when you hear the dialogue. So being excluded from the dialogue, I'm not even sure if all my questions would be answered, because the dialogue may have generated more questions for me.
There certainly is nothing that precludes the board from having and establishing even a schedule, if it likes, of interim meeting dates by which the subcommittee and council or staff reports to the full board on the progress, the current issues, if there are additional issues that have come up as parties have negotiated, or if board members who are not a member of the committee have additional issues or concerns based upon further review or prior progress report.
The other concern I have is that there's two people on the board who have had more concerns than others in the past. Those are the two being excluded from the meeting.
No, I disagree with that.
My perception.
Mm-hmm. I'm entitled to your opinion. Go ahead. Ms. Menendez-Menez?
No? Thank you. Go ahead. We have a very limited time frame, as I understand. We have to make a decision within 60 days, correct?
Let me clarify that. You have 60 days to make a decision to approve or deny the petition unless the board and the petitioner agree to an extension of 30 days. Now, one of the issues I think we've attempted to point out is that one of our concerns is that the sort of petition and the contractual relationship are kind of intertwined. So one of the recommendations we've had and one of the discussions I've had with Mr. Simmons is sort of pulling out those items that we really consider contractual deal points that are as opposed to the simple elements of the petition under the statute. So a typical process is that you will review a petition and then based upon the approval of that petition negotiate either an operating agreement and or a facilities use agreement. There's nothing that precludes the evaluation of a petition and the negotiation of an operating agreement and or an MOU within that 60-day or 90-day timeline. But the statutory timeline requirement technically really only applies to approval or denial of the petition and not the related or ancillary documents.
If we decide not to do a subcommittee, then could we meet weekly until we work this out and make sure that we're within the time frame to keep it transparent?
The board can meet as much as it likes on that issue.
Okay.
All right. I have a motion on the table, and it's a motion by Mike Spence, seconded by Eileen Miranda Jimenez, to set up a board subcommittee to meet with the parties to discuss those items that we brought up today, some of the other concerns of our attorneys, and then report back to the board as a whole. I hear very clearly some of the concerns of the other board members. What I'd like to do is call for a vote on this item, but understand that let's just do one meeting. See what that happens and come back, report to the board, and if we make a determination that's something that we need to do on a regular basis, we'll continue with it. If not, then we'll come back and go back and meet together as a board as a whole. With that motion, is all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion passes 3-2 with Cox Spence, Miranda Jimenez, voting yes, and Polison Shoemaker voting no. All right. Is there anything else? Any other items of business come before the board on this item?
So this will be back at our next meeting?
At our next meeting on the 24th.
And by the way, you know, at that time when we reevaluate it, I'm open to other ideas. What I don't want to have happen is what's happened for 18 months where we can't find a way where a majority of the board, we can even figure out what a majority of the board would like to do regarding a certain item. We need to have a mechanism to do that, and we haven't been able to do that for 18 months on a lot of different issues relating to the charter school, and I think that just adds to not getting anything done. So if someone has another alternative.
We'll give this a try, and we'll see what happens. All right. Okay. And with that, we will adjourn this public hearing and special board meeting. And there being no further business to come before the board, the special meeting has adjourned at 8 o'clock this evening. We will take a short break before we reconvene the meeting to honor public comment regarding the closed session item before us.